actually the insight of what happens if people want to
Okay, good afternoon everybody. Can I welcome you to this seminar on children as consumers, public policies, moral dilemmas and academic perspectives. And that's quite a mountain to climb this afternoon, it seems to me. My name is Clem Henriksen from the National Family and Parenting Institute. And our co-sponsors for this afternoon's seminar are Frank Trentman from Birkbeck College and Anne Phoenix from the Open University. I'm delighted to chair this exciting seminar on a hugely complex and emotive issue. The topicality of children's consumerism couldn't be greater with national panic over childhood obesity and litigation looming for McDonald's and all the rest of them. Could this, heaven forbid, all be a degree of fuss about nothing? After all, fads and overblown anxieties often mushroom in the child-rearing business. Or do we seriously have to do more than is currently the case to regulate children as consumers? And if so, what should we be doing? That's the issue we're here to discuss, and in doing so, practical and philosophical issues are going to abound. For example, what level of risk are we prepared to take with children as consumers? What role do the pros and cons of the nanny state have to play? Do we have anxieties on that score? What are the media control options? What are our hopes of self-regulation? What about marketing ethics? What are the options for using tax as a lever to reduce advertising and consuming with obesity risks? What about commercial freedom of speech? What role do peers and the parent-child relationship play? And what about children's agency and rights? After all, it might just be conceivable that children have a right to be marketed to. Would investing in media and consumer literacy for children help, or would it be a waste of money and a smokescreen for letting the marketing lobby off the hook? These are all hugely important questions and linked themes, and we're going to explore them with an eminent panel of speakers. We've got Professor Stephen Klein from the Simon Fraser University in Canada, Vicky Schottbold, Head of Communications at NFPI, Dr. Brian Young from the University of Exeter, and later on we've got Professor Sonia Livingston from LSE, Dr. Sharon Bowden, University of Leicester, Professor Karen Ekstrom, the Centre for Consumer Science in Gothenburg, and we're having a concluding discussion from Anne Phoenix. For my session, which will be the first three speakers, I'm going to ask each speaker to talk to us for 15 minutes. And after all have spoken, we'll be going into questions and discussions, which I hope will be plentiful. The session will end with tea. And just a reminder that all the papers which the presentations are based on are available in your pack. And if they aren't there, we'll get them to you later. Okay, so our first speaker is Stephen Klein, who's going to talk about sedentary lifestyle or fast food culture, lessons from the Battle of the Bulge. And I think a lot of us will be hiding away when we hear about that. Stephen.
Thanks very much. I've jammed a fair bit into this presentation with a kind of shock and awe approach to academic discourse, and I'm going to try and rush through it for Frank's sake. I apologize for the speed with which I'm going to do it. My paper calls for a fundamental rethinking of our ideas about consumer socialization by putting it in the context of the risk society. And so it begins with my attempt to put the current debates about TV marketing in the context of 40-year-long struggle, political struggle, over value and sensibilities promoted in children's commercial media.
Rocket launcher!
Fire! The fire will pull off! Get that, it was! I'm going in! Cobra ice sabers, G.I. Joe Brawler and figures sold separately. Plasma knocks not available.
G.I. Joe!
You're gonna see a real blast!
G.I. Joe!
one side of this debate are the school and parenting advocates who believe that something has gone wrong in Playland. They find it increasingly difficult to induct children into the mysteries of enlightenment civility.
It's you and me, get on Barbie, working it, you got smooth moves. Hot toes to the ground, move your body all around. Shoes, so you can really hit it.
The call to arms asks governments to recognize the vulnerability and to preserve the innocence of children in the face of ruthless corporate propaganda machine selling aggressive games and fattening snacks to our kids.
Hi, I'm one of the kids who was prosecuted for downloading music free off of the internet. And I'm here to announce in front of 100 million people we're still going to download music free off of the internet.
On the other side are the marketers applying the latest tools of kidfluence, defending their right to inform children about the delights of our consumer culture directly via their advertising campaigns. Children, they argue, are not hapless dupes and victims, but media-savvy customers who are in many cases more competent than their parents in dealing with the media-saturated world. Their mantra refuses the myth of advertising's overwhelming influence on kids and invokes their own rights of commercial expression. For the last 40 years, mediated marketing has been the oft contentious heart of this debate. Presenting research that indicates the media competence of even young children, media literacy advocates in Britain and America have recently dismissed the concerns of anxious parents, arguing there is no proof that watching violent entertainment contributes to aggression any more than watching McDonald's ads makes kids fat. With many social historians, I would agree that over the last 40 years, commercial media have expanded children's cultural horizons in many ways and granted them new scope to explore their own interests and lifestyles. But in their Panglossian enthusiasm for consumer freedoms, what is often ignored by the marketing industry's claims about the competence of children is that a dark shadow of social and environmental crisis, i.e. the risk society, continues to be cast across children's daily lives, from bullying and cyberstalking to obesity and mad cow disease. This is an issue with a long history, and the public controversies over violent entertainment and obesity have also revealed deep underlying tensions in the ideology of vulnerability of children. And it is the evidence that links children's media consumption to violence and obesity that have fueled and agitated these protracted political battles between parents and industry over children's contemporary lifestyle risks. Other presenters will explain the debates in more detail about children's media literacies and marketing effects. But I want to note here that these ongoing struggles, these political battles that have been waged over media risks between parents and marketers, are symptomatic of an emerging new politics of childhood in the risk society. And in the wake of the Jamie Bulger slaying and the schoolyard massacres in America, the wisdom of allowing toy and video game makers to market violent toys and games to young children has been frequently contested, but with little effect. As Fritz Holling said, violence sells, money talks, and no amount of self-regulation and no amount of antitrust exemptions is going to change the profit incentive. And there has been
And now from Bedrock, this late-breaking story. McDonald's is rolling out the Flintstones Happy Meal. There's the Rebels rounding the McDonald's, and Pebbles and Dino out for a spin. What toy would eat Happy Meal you buy your kids?
So too, the WHO's documentation of rising obesity rates has intensified public pressure on fast food, soft drink, and confection marketers to acknowledge that they do contribute to shifting preferences for calorie-dense foods. The grumbles in Parliament and has been pressuring them to be more thoughtful in their direct-to-child promotions. Although the industry does not deny the considerable marketing weight behind the bad five calorie dense food sector and the rather lackluster marketing of healthy alternatives for children, they oppose the advertising ban as overprotective and censorious. The regulatory system is working to screen inappropriate ads and helping children make appropriate lifestyle choices. And it's the parents' responsibility, not theirs, to teach children about the risks.
And Grandma, what did she have?
All the better to eat.
So much,
I think somebody's hungry.
Honey Nut Cheerios.
I hate it when this happens.
Because real golden honey makes every oath an irresistible part of this good breakfast.
Sorry, Red. Nothing personal.
Honey Nut Cheerios.
Now in marked boxes of Frosted or Honey Nut Cheerios, there's a free sample of new crispy M&Ms.
I'm toast.
Sorry, dude.
Until now, tobacco has been the legal benchmark for thinking about promotion of risky products in the marketplace. Faced with growing evidence of risks, the tobacco companies agreed to a voluntary ban on TV advertising. Most states restricted underage access to cigarettes in shops, mandated dramatic risk labeling, and undertook considerable risk education, including many counter-advertising campaigns. And although the court cases continued, and the science is still inconclusive on causality, the public battles over health risks associated with smoking has been moderately successful in changing smoking behavior. In jurisdictions like BC and California, for example, where risk communication has been taken seriously, the incidence of youth smoking has halved. Current rates of smoking are at historical lows in BC, 16.5% compared to current ones in Britain, which are 33% for youth cigarette smoking. I think there are two challenges to policymakers in relationship to the marketing, these questions around the marketing of lifestyle risks. The first is to our conceptions of media and consumer literacy. And even if we are convinced that children can competently choose their pleasures, are we sure that they are capable of making the complex benefit-risk trade-offs that we all face in a consumer marketplace? The second is the challenge to governmental responsibilities to ensure that we adequately communicate about lifestyle risks to children so that they can become eventually competent consumers in a risk society.
So you sold my client these chocolate chips, and look, no warning label, just pretty picture. Just look what this reckless cookie-making business has done to my client. Your Honor, obviously she's guilty and needs to pay me, my client, damages. You make them taste good on purpose, don't you?
I guess so.
Learn more about lawyers cashing in on obesity at consumerfreedom.com.
A major part of my paper is to look at the battle of McDonald's in the United States and the legal issues. I'm just going to distill 5 points that I think come out of that study. One is that lifestyle risks are a matter of personal choice, has been ruled by the American courts around this issue. Industry has a right to free commercial expression. The liability demands proof of harm before legislation on risks can be attributed. Corporations must make risk information available on demand at point of sale. And mandated risk labels and parental advisories are not constitutional in the United States, although it's never been tested in other jurisdictions. I'm quickly going to move on to talk about the implications of this for the debate about obesity in Britain. Factors contributing to obesity are obviously both sedentary lifestyles and food consumption. It's the balance, the relationship between both of these issues. We have good evidence that children are becoming more sedentary, watching more television, playing less sports, etc. And we also know that children are intensively exposed in their television viewing, and this is the problem with sedentary lifestyles. lifestyles is that most of it is spent in front of the TV, and the TV increases their risk of exposure to fast food advertising and commercials. So the tension between those two ideas is a kind of false idea that the industry is promoting as a trade-off. I would argue that there are three reasons why there's a strong relationship between amount of television viewing, particularly over 4 hours of television consumption, about 25% of the American population, and exposure to more snack and food commercials. They do habitual snacking while watching, so that there's a linking of these behaviors. And they tend to give up other active leisure activities as they make choices in their lifestyles to spend their entertainment time in front of you. There is also recent evidence about the effect of heavy TV viewing on the formation of preferences. In this case, the viewing of food. I'm sorry, I'm running over. I'm going to.
You're okay. You've got a few, 5 more minutes.
This is an account. It's often argued that there is and I want to make an argument about the sum total. It's not the individual effects of an individual ad, but the sum total of promotional discourse for food sectors, particularly the fast food outlets and confectionaries. And this is basically American data that I quickly threw together over the last 4 years. You can see that in particular fast food, this is in, so about total marketing per year in the top 100 advertisers accounts for about $3.5 billion annually. And most of that information, as you've seen from the commercials I've been showing, do not talk about the risks associated with the lifestyle of fast food consumption and sedentary lifestyles. And so in thinking of policy around this issue, I noticed in the papers the other day there was the hamburger tax was floated one more time through various circles. I think this is a silly way of going about it. We have to remember, for example, that businesses get a tax concession for advertising. In other words, it's seen as a legitimate business expenditure. So they don't have to pay tax on the part of their corporate investments in the production of advertising, in that case about $3.5 billion a year in America. So it's possible to remove the tax concessions for particular kinds of products, particularly if advertisers refuse to provide risk information or lifestyle risk information in the context of their advertising. And such a move will not be subject to the arguments about freedom of commercial speech in the way that a ban would. And so I think there are other ways to force a change or to accelerate the change, because I think there's already evidence that the food companies, because of the public panic, are beginning to respond and pay attention to this issue. So to mobilize more attention, I think we should think about the systemic biases of risk versus promotional information in the marketplace and begin to think of legislative approaches that allow us to create more balance. The second thing I've argued is this notion of media literacy. And I just want to say that currently a lot of people, colleagues who say that kids are media savvy, consumer savvy, they don't need any education. I disagree over the concept of media literacy. I'm using the concept critical media literacy, and that means that it includes the notion of the risks and the risk-taking involved in children's consumer behavior. In this case, there was, the logic is, if there is a risk associated with heavy media consumption, then the more kids watch, the more they're at risk. Then if we reduce the amount of television they watch, if we act to counteract their sedentary lifestyles, we should reduce the risks associated. A study in San Jose by Tom Robinson found that, in fact, an intervention, a media education intervention, was successful. We duplicated that in Canada, and I'll just.
I'm really excited about it. And one of the activities was, again, getting them to act out, and we got them to make commercials. And we said, okay, if you had to make commercials for a group of kids who wanted to take part in this challenge, what would you do?
So turn off your TV and go outside and have a little fun in the sun.
If you want to be cool, you gotta turn off your TV.
Our primary objectives became making tuning up the screen a cool thing to do.
You got to tune up TV, you got to tune up TV, you gotta turn it off.
It was using what they know and bringing it into the classroom and taking their knowledge and trying to form into a way that we can help educate them about the media.
The data indicated that the children were successful in their attempt to reduce their media consumption. 8.8% of the children chose not to participate in Tune-Up Week, and 51.3% of the children chose to go cold turkey.
Well, it was fun, and I was cold turkey, and I didn't do any media.
It was no problem. I just went outside.
So I think we really succeeded in trying to make going without media as cool as media had been prior.
I didn't sneak peek.
And we were quite shocked. Like they were happy. They were, this is great, this is easy. And some of the kids asked if they could do it for the rest of the summer. And I'm like, go ahead, you know, it's totally up to you. So they definitely succeeded in completing the Tune-Up Week challenge.
According to the parents, the children did not see Tune-Up Week as a chore, but rather an opportunity to try new things.
She was inviting me out to play tennis and badminton. We played a lot of badminton that week. They knew what to do with themselves when there wasn't TV and computers.
I went bike riding, which I don't really usually get lunch anymore. And I had a water fight with my friend, and we barely...
Thanks. I don't want to cut you short, but there are some...
Anyone who's interested, this is available on the website, so you can have a look.
Well, obviously, I didn't know that not watching, you know, TV amounted to cold turkey. Not in my day. But thank you, Stephen, for that fascinating exploration of risk and consumers' issues, and that obviously runs through our social fabric. I'm going to move swiftly on to Vicky Shotgold, Head of Communications at LFPI, who's going to talk about hard sell, soft targets, the view of parents on marketing to children.
Before I can speak, I'm just going to check something. Okay, I'm here to talk about what parents have told us about marketing to children. Just a tiny, weeny bit of background about the National Family and Parenting Institute. Our role is to make Britain more family-friendly. We listen to what parents have to say, and we try to make sure that their needs, views, and opinions are thought about and listened to. And it is kind of astonishing how often parents get ignored when people are talking about for and to children and young people. And that's probably never truer than when we're talking about companies who decide that they're going to target children directly as customers. So perhaps we shouldn't have been surprised when the NFPI asked parents how they felt about this issue, that they expressed a very high level of frustration and indeed irritation. 84% of the parents that we talked to when we were doing some work around what makes Britain family friendly, which was a much wider, more general study that we did last year, 84% of them said that they felt that companies targeted their children too much. But why worry? As some of the parents in our discussion group said, there was never a golden age when children were not exposed to marketing forces. Is there a danger, as Glenn mentioned in her introduction, that as in so many other areas of their lives, adults are stepping in to restrict their choices and independent decision-making through being overprotective? Well, that's probably a question which would take me away from the purpose of my talk, and it's probably something that other people will talk about. But I think it's fair to say that what parents are experiencing and what they're now talking about, I think, is the effects of a massive increase in marketing spending. The preschool market alone in this country is worth £4.3 billion. So I think it's really important that we're clear that parents are not inventing this anxiety. They are facing an industry that's targeting their children, and so it's not surprising that they're starting to feel overwhelmed. I'm going to show you now an advert from Kellogg's. This appeared in Marketing Week in the trade press that recruits marketing people. It's very hard to read, so I'm going to read it for you. It says, the Cocoa Pops, Fruit Wonders, cereal and milk bars and Frosties are just a few of the fun brands you will need to get under the skin of in this role. Here you will spend your time understanding kids, finding out what interests them, establishing which other brands they associate with, and appreciating the realms of pester power. And I show that just by way of dealing with one of the things that the advertising industry the industry have said to us, which is that they don't encourage pester power. What they do is just promote their products to a warm and receptive audience, and the impact that it has is simply to move loyalty from one brand to another. We would say, not so, we don't believe you, and in fact, you even put adverts in the marketing press that say that's what you do. So we just kind of like to put that one to bed. There's another advert here which I think is just great and kind of demonstrates what parents talk about. This one is particularly irritating because it came from a CBeebies magazine, a BBC in-house magazine that's for preschool children. And what it says is, Mum, please can I wash my hair with Fast Dry Shampoo? It's a brand new shampoo that dries really, really fast so I can play for longer. And it's got two great flavours, Burst Pineapple Flash and Burst Cool Melon. Please, Mum, please. Now, you'd have to say that the mother who just wants to go and choose a shampoo that's right for her family would have a tough job answering her five-year-old, which is where this advert is targeted. So moving along, as my producer decided to move ahead of me, I'm going to read to you now just a few of the quotes, because I think that's the thing that you're probably most interested in, that we've had from parents when we've asked them about this. We had dozens, hundreds of them, and it's been quite hard to choose the ones that kind of explain the sort of frustration that they expressed to us, so this is just a little selection. My kids are always tricked into being contract number for something, whether it's the sweets at the checkout counter in Tesco or the latest mobile for my daughter, aged just 13. Interesting from where we're sitting, because we're doing some work at the moment with a mobile phone company, who say that they don't actually promote mobile phones to children. So, don't know what that says. The thing that annoys me about advertising aimed at children is the way at this time of year it increases. We clearly did this at Christmas. And I can guarantee that my seven-year-old is convinced that she just cannot do without this product she has just seen advertised. I've lost count of the number of tantrums I've had in Asda because I won't let the girls have cereal just as a free gift. You walk into Woolworths and they've got pencil cases, they've got books, they've got everything. They do it because they know what children are like. I don't think it should be put on the shelves so easily. And this isn't just about children asking their parents for more stuff. Parents are also concerned about the messages that adverts are sending to their children. And this next one kind of demonstrates that quite nicely. In fact, it's not that one. The advert shows you a little boy, and his mum has given him this dairy slice, and he's saying how good his mum was. And then this other poor boy only had sandwiches, so his mum was really cruel. You know, and that's the wrong impression, that your mum's really cool if she buys you this crappy cheese, this plastic cheese. That's fair enough, really. And the next quote that I've got from a parent for you is where parents have talked to us about the impact advertising can have on relationships within the family and how it makes parents feel when they've got to start to try and deal with this tidal wave of activity. You sound like a dragon to your children. You're constantly putting them down. Everything they've just been told is wonderful. I'm constantly negative about these things. It's not as good as that. It's rubbish. It's cheap. It's nasty. And they've made it out to be some wonderful item. And this last one, which continues on that theme, I feel like I have to keep saying no, because obviously with two children, I'm working and I just haven't got the money, and they want this, and I'm forever going, no, 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 no. And what the kids must think of me. Oh, I hate mum. She never buys me anything. It does get really upsetting sometimes. So let me just summarise what parents have said to us. Parents are particularly irritated by the massive growth and ubiquity of product tie-ins. And that's one that I'm going to sign up to myself. As a parent of a five-year-old, I can say that from vests and underpants to special children's food ranges, the branding industry has taken over our children's wardrobes, diets, moved into our schools and into their leisure time. I don't think any parent could possibly not empathise with that. Parents think that the effects of this high level of marketing does affect their children adversely. They speak of marketing being important in shaping and forming their children's views of themselves and the world around them. They express dismay at the way in which marketing encourages spending and a throwaway mentality. And that's a real concern for parents, of what the advertising is doing is encouraging kids to think that you buy something and you might not even want it. So the cereal example, where you buy it because the toy's in there and then you chuck away the cereal, worries parents a lot. Parents feel under pressure to make certain purchases. They do try to resist the pressure, but they all speak of extra aggravation and arguments, tears and tantrums that it's causing, which is an example of where we would say that companies are making family life hard, actively making family life harder than it needs to be. And you have to go to a supermarket to watch that happen. Parents do believe that it's their responsibility to deal with marketing and to try and exercise restraint on their children's demands. Few of them believe that they can realistically reduce their children's exposure to marketing, which links into this general feeling that parents express again and again and again, that they're being overwhelmed and that there is nothing that they can do to stand up to this unlevel playing field. But parents were unsure about regulation achieving anything. They said that they felt that regulation may be counterproductive, that it might mean that these clever and cynical marketing people would just spend their money elsewhere. But they do come up with specific proposals, like stopping the advertising of junk food on television. So what does the NFPI think should happen? Well, the full recommendations are in our report. And I would just say this isn't some strange and weird test. The printer's actually stapled it in back to front, so when you open it, just flip it the other way around to get to it. So, we are saying advertising to under fives should be banned during TV programmes. Advertising junk food should be banned during children's television, including on terrestrial TV. We think there needs to be more research on the cumulative effects of blocks of adverts reoccurring frequently on children's television to ascertain whether codes of practice need to be amended. I don't know how often you all watch children's television, but the way that the advertising industry checks adverts at the moment is one by one, so you can complain about a specific advert, but nobody's taking responsibility for watching the 10 or so adverts that children watch one after the other, and we think that that needs to be looked at. Options to bring together all the broad strategic issues to do with marketing to children should be investigated. Vending machines selling carbonated drinks, sweets, crisps and other snacks should be banned from school, and each school should ensure that it has enough working water fountains. And finally, we think that parents should be informed by their children's school of all company marketing initiatives. It's been an interesting experience for us because it's one of the questions that we asked in our focus groups about the levels of marketing that's going on in our schools. And they had a sense of things that they were unhappy with, like the Cadbury's initiative and the Walker's Crisp initiative, but they were very unaware of the actual levels. And now that we've encouraged them to go and have a look at the levels of marketing in their children's schools, and they're starting to ask the question, then they're starting to come back and say, my God, there are 10 running in my school, there are 6 and every single thing that my kid does in the classroom. Is what some companies may want. Let me just finish by saying that these recommendations are based on what parents tell us. As an institute, of course, we believe in the need for an evidence-based response, but we also believe in the precautionary principle. We think that there's a moral issue here, and we recognise that parents feel overwhelmed. They're identifying a negative impact on their family life, and they're identifying an industry that's making their life more difficult than it needs to be. And we think that it's incumbent on people to listen to that and to make the playing field just a little bit more level.
Thank you, Vicky. That's an excellent description of the parents' perspective on all of this. Can I go on to our last speaker, Dr. Brian Young, who's going to talk about, does advertising to children make them fat? A sceptical gaze at irreconcilable differences.
Thank you very much, Jo. I don't have PowerPoint presentation, so I shall be doing this with quill pen and loud voice. I'll start off by discussing what the mechanics of obesity are, and then go on to some examination of a couple of studies which I've looked at, where perhaps the evidence that is provided maybe it doesn't exactly correspond with the impression that you may read in the press of what is actually happening. I shall read out one or two parts of the paper and add a look to the other parts and hopefully get finished in time for plenty of discussion. Whether someone is fat or not is the consequence of a complex interplay of various factors And there's no disagreement at all amongst any of the authorities that I have read that obesity is a multifactorial issue. A recent report by the World Health Organization in 2003 recognizes this and the extent to which a longitudinal approach to the whole development of obesity is needed. I'm using the expression in the developmental sense, so that these factors are potentially operated from conception to death. I have no problem with this either, and this approach does justice to the holistic nature of obesity, as well as accounting for the variety of parameters operated on a global scale. The parameters that are operated can be classified in various different ways, and the ones that the WHO use are the fact that there's a genetic contribution, an environmental, a biological, and a social cultural contribution, a cluster of variables under each of these headings. There are various measures of obesity, and BMI, the body mass index, is probably the best known of them. The WHO do claim that obesity is a global epidemic, that it's serious, that it is complex and incompletely understood disease, and it can be classified as a chronic non-communicable disease. This discourse relies on basically medical concepts, but again, one would anticipate that given the nature of the World Health Organization. So that's the ingredients of obesity. The mechanics of obesity are reasonably simple and reasonably easy to communicate to the lay public. The simplest definition is the excessive accumulation of fat in the body. And the cause is quite simple. Fat accumulates when more calories are consumed than are expended. And this immediately leads into quite a useful concrete metaphor, which can be communicable to the lay public with metaphors such as a balance sheet with food intake versus energy expenditure. What is less easy to get across is the developmental trajectory of obesity over the lifespan and the extent to which, from conception to death, all of these factors are interrelated. This is not just due to the hard science that's involved in this, but it's also despite the fact that there are popular science books on genetics, the extent to which genetics only functions as an expression in interaction with other variables, such as environmental variables in most cases, especially in behaviours. The press seem more inclined to discuss the fat gene being identified, where any claims about a genetic contribution to obesity seems to lead to a lessening of personal responsibility by the court sufferer and a greater need to protect those who, through no fault of their own, have inherited this affliction. However, the mechanics of the contribution of obesity are less well understood at the time of writing, and even the percentage of variance in large samples that can be attributed to heritability varies between 25 and 40%. Now, where do we locate food advertising and marketing to children in this mix? What has been rather awkwardly called the obesogenic environment encourages obesity. The coming together of economic, political, cultural, and social changes encourages dietary patterns where food with high caloric density are consumed frequently and intermittently, and exercise is discouraged. So most countries are moving towards an environment where fertility rates are falling, life expectancy is growing, social structures, including marriage, are changing, the family dramatically, and urban development is growing. Children have fewer safe places to play, there is declining agriculture and increasing working mothers, and less home-cooked food, and so on and so forth. All of these taken together are conducive to the development of obesity globally. Again, we don't really see much of advertising to children so far, but we'll come to that just in a minute. The WHO report is considered systematically, and they categorise evidence into various categories. So, for example, there's convincing evidence, and there's evidence which is not completely convincing, but it's probable evidence. Probable evidence is based on studies that show fairly consistent associations between exposure and disease, but where there are perceived shortcomings in available evidence or some evidence to the contrary, precluding a more definite judgment. Shortcomings in the evidence may be any of the following, and so on, they elaborate on that. They've come to the conclusion that heavy marketing of fast food outlets and energy-dense, micronutrient-poor foods and beverages are a causative and probable risk factor that might promote weight gain and obesity. This is based on only 4 individual research studies out of a total number of 27 citations in that particular section of the WHO report. On this evidence, they claim that the heavy marketing of these foods and beverages to young children causes obesity is not unequivocal. There is sufficient indirect evidence to warrant this practice being placed in the probably category and thus becoming a potential target for interventions. In the paper, which you'll have in front of you, and you can read the details later, I've gone through these, detailed them and analysed them closely, and I've come to the general conclusion that the evidence is non-existent for that. There's one particular paper where the authors themselves state that the effects were weak and complex, and that it would not be appropriate to speculate deeply either on the mechanisms of these effects or their likely long-term behavioural consequences. This paper and others are cited in support of this contention that is a probable risk factor in obesity. Now, that is one issue, and my argument is now developing to the extent where I'm thinking, well, perhaps if you go into the detailed evidence that is available and go right down to the bottom level and open the box and look at the actual references that are cited and see what's being done in the name of providing this evidence, you might find some one or two interesting bits of information. Let me just quickly go into something which is of recent interest, which is the Food Standards Agency report on this subject. The Food Standards Agency do make the claim that this is the first British study in this particular area. My contention is that it is not the first British study in this area, because in 1996, a report into the role of advertising in children's food choice was published by the Ministry of Agriculture, Fisheries and Food. There were four authors from two UK universities, and I was one of the lead authors. I was the lead author from the University of Exeter. We were all developmental psychologists with different interests, one in economic socialisation, another one, myself, in advertising for children, one in infant research, and one in the development of diet through preferences and habits in young children. We decided early in this project to frame the discussion in terms of the development of the child and look at one of the major problems that the child faces, how the infant progresses from being reliant on a single source of food, usually the milk of the mother, and develops from that become reliant on a huge different variety of foods depending on the culture in which that child lives. So we adopted that particular model, and we looked at the literature in light of that model. We concluded with a rather conservative conclusion that there was some evidence that advertising had an effect at the level of the brand, but there was no evidence, substantive evidence, that advertising affected the consumption of categories of food. I think it's important to realise that when you are promoting foods themselves and single advertisements, you can have an effect where children like the brand more, can consume perhaps more of that brand, and also have more favourable attitudes and greater knowledge about that brand. That's not in dispute, I don't think. What is in dispute is that a cluster of brands that form a food category can be promoted by advertising, and that cluster of food products can constitute what is known as an unhealthy diet. So there are different levels that have to be analysed, and the evidence perhaps is available at the brand level, but not at any of the higher levels, in my opinion. So in 2003, the report from the Food Standards Agency was issued in a fanfare of publicity in late 2003. It makes impressive reading, but I don't particularly want to pick over the details of the research at the moment. What I did do, what I have done, is look at the report in a lot of detail and look at the language that the authors use. The language in the Food Standards Agency report, if you look at the actual volume itself, is generally tentative. The researchers take a cautious or even conservative approach. The evaluation of studies is peppered with comments such as, 8 studies provide evidence of varying strength, considered to be or classified as unhealthy, reasonably robust evidence, reasonably strong evidence, and modest evidence, and so on. Even if one didn't know the literature, the general impression is that in the detail is one of canny and cautious evaluation. When the information, the difference is an academic difference, where they would make claims, for example, that there is a category effect of advertising, we thought there wasn't. So that's a dispute between academics, and again, this is not the place to go over in fine detail why we didn't reach the same conclusions. But the evidence on which this report is based is basically the same evidence that we looked at, with one or two exceptions of papers published since 1996, the same evidence that we looked at. There's no difference in the evidence, really. The language in the conclusions and in the Food Standards Agency press releases is much more assertive and gives the impression of being based upon solid and substantial evidence. Many studies have found clear effects and they've used sophisticated methodologies. The literature does suggest food promotion is influencing children's diets in a number of ways. There also seems to be a couple of confusion in the meaning of the term significant, where in the actual report itself, significance is refers to statistical significance and whether results are statistically significant. In the press reports, the term significant means basically important conclusions. And we read in the press reports that this is a comprehensive and extremely thorough review of evidence on this important and complex issue. It reaches a number of significant conclusions about the link between promotional activities and children's eating behaviour. In particular, it concludes that advertising in children does have an effect on their preferences, purchase behaviour and consumption, and these effects are apparent not just for different brands, but also for different types of food. My contention would be that the evidence does not justify such an assertive conclusion as that, and I would be much, much more tentative. The precautionary principle, I think, was referred to before. Maybe we want to discuss the extent to which food advertising should be subject to the precautionary principle. I'm not alone in this. Professor Dr. Ashton, in his editorial in the Journal of the Royal Society, quoting David Hume, that a wise man proportions his belief to the evidence, does agree, with my contention as well, that the evidence is perhaps not there in the detail to justify perhaps such assertive and strong conclusions. And that is my speech, talk, delivery.
Right, thanks, Brian. So, well, a fraught and complex relationship between regulators and the regulated, essentially, and the research behind it. And it provides us with a really stimulating starting point for our discussion. So, the floor is yours at this stage. We've got 20 minutes. And if you could just say who you are, where you're from, and either discussion points or questions, you're welcome. Thank you. Anyone have anything to say on these issues? Yes?
Tim Jackson. I'm from the Centre for Environment and Strategy in the University of Surrey. And I have at the moment a research fellowship funded by ESRC on which is entitled Towards a Social Psychology of Sustainable Consumption. So my interest is really in consumer behaviours and consumer behaviour patterns as they relate to their impact on the environment. Increasingly, of course, that would include the behaviours of children as consumers. I guess I have several things to say. The first is that the principle of proportion probably achieved prominence in relation to the environmental debates. And it's something where I think the scientific and policy discussions really open up very profound questions about the David Hume quote that you finished with in relation to proportional belief according to the evidence. And one of the ways in which that is opened out is really that one must proportion actions in relation to consequences. And it also opens up very profound questions about the nature of particular kinds of evidence bases and the way in which those evidence bases are or are not relevant to a precautionary action in a particular case. So that's my first point, really, that I have a lot of misgivings about an approach which looks at the evidence and ends up with a quote by David Hume, which seems to bypass a precautionary element in policymaking. It does seem to me, both as a parent and as a researcher, that you know, if there is a place to apply the precautionary principle, it has to be in relation to the development of children. So that's kind of point one. The second point, and I open myself up here to be shot down by people who know a great deal more about it, but one of the models which I've been looking in some detail in relation to my social psychology of sustainable consumption, is models that are specifically social psychological in relation to identity construction. For example, one of those models is the symbolic self-completion theory of Bickland and Gollitzer. And the suggestion of that model is essentially that identity, self-identity, is a social construct, which involves a process of discursive elaboration between the individual and the peer group. And the discursive elaboration revolves in particular about a certain set of resources, the symbolic resources that are associated with the construction of identity. And amongst those symbolic resources, as, for example, Richard Elliott's pointed out quite clearly, are the symbolic resources associated with the media, with advertising, with brands, and so on and so forth. Now, that's a very particular theory about the way in which identity is constructed. And if one then takes that theory in conjunction with the ideas around development psychology, which suggest that the locus for discursive elaboration changes according to stages of development. And the early stages, clearly the discursive elaboration process is one which can and does involve parental influence. But as any parent will tell you, that locus of discursive elaboration changes quite fast. In fact, it changes sort of around about the age of five, when children go to school and begin to establish peer group communities, which are of incredibly strong importance in these social elaboration processes and the construction of subsequent identity. Now, it does seem to me that taken together, those two things cast a great deal of doubt on the ability to reflect the responsibility for controlling children's consumption behavior in a risk society back upon parents, particularly in the situation in which the discursive resources, the peer group elaboration of identity require, are essentially thrown onto the free market and the interests of commercial advertisers. So it does seem to me that that's, you know, it places doubts in my mind about falling short of quite strong standards in relation to children's advertising. It calls into question, I mean, I love the conclusions that are coming from the FPI study, in particular that you should ban advertising for children under five, but it does seem to me that from a developmental perspective and from the perspective of these social psychological constructions of identity, it doesn't go far enough, because it's at the age of five specifically that these peer group pressures and the symbolic resources that inform those peer group pressures become most important. So, I mean, from a precautionary point of view, from the point of view of these kind of construction theories of identity, from the point of view of development psychology, I don't see that it's possible to escape from a policy situation that takes a much stronger line in relation to advertising and control of those symbolic resources.
Well, I mean,
that's
sorry, just on that very specific point, it was a practical decision in a way that it would be relatively straightforward to ban advertising to 25s. It becomes much more complex to identify television advertising for over 5s. So it's simply that you can identify the preschool marketing. You could do something about that, for instance.
Yes. Can I just come back on that point? Because I've been trying to grasp the essence of the point. The argument that you have is that there's a mythology called the free market of ideas with respect to children, that in fact there's not a free market of ideas because there are particular people with access, particular access that they're grinding. Is that one of the...
That's one of the constitutions of that.
Yeah. In which case, my argument would be counter to that, because I cannot see that in this day and age you can have a disinterested discourse or an arena or a place where or a space where disinterested discourse can be conducted. It used to be thought that the school, and especially universities, were sort of monastic, isolated environments where this sort of discourse exists. And my argument, and I was talking to Stephen earlier on about this, and he might want to say something on it, is that we live in a culture where promotional and discourses are dominant, and everyone has got a particular interest in getting a point of view across. This is not unnatural. I mean, communication theory has gone beyond the sort of dispassionate cold ideas of Grice and so on. And most theory in ethnic communications and feminist theory in communications would argue that it's the nature of the social relationship that drives the discourse and the point of view of the other has got to be taken into account, as well as the communicator, the source and the communicator, and the receiver are locked together in some sort of discussion contract. Now, I would accept that, but the real point is, rather than saying we must find a space for the child in order to have this dispassionate discourse, we then have got to map out where these promotional discourses are coming from and what they're like, and whether in fact there is some other alternative discourse pointing out the risks from another point of view.
If I can, sure, can I chime in?
Caution and proportionality, where should we go?
I agree with most of the points, except not to conclude where to not really take it, which is, and I agree with Brian, that the issue in a risk society, and what I've tried to point out, is that we haven't taken that concept seriously in relationship to consumer citizenship of children. And if we take that concept seriously, then we shouldn't buffer kids from, we should try and alter the system so that kids do become aware of the both the problems and the pleasures available in the consumer marketplace. And if we expect them to make responsible choices by the time they're 12, then we have to seriously think about what the literacy conditions are that allow them, enable them to be competent consumers in a risk society. And that's the challenge I'm issuing. Rather than strategically continue to buffer children from the promotional arm, let's take seriously the notion that this is a much more complex marketplace now, and that we have to think about what that means for educational institutions. And that puts the responsibility, I think, back on government, and interestingly, Ofcom now has a notion of media literacy, and I think the political agenda has to be to crack that open so that it doesn't become, you know, the media smart people, it doesn't become advertisers teaching kids, as it is in America, about what consumer responsibilities mean. And I think that I'm just putting the opposite agenda out there.
Can I ask anyone else has got a view on the literacy issue and whether that's feasible, or is it, I suggest it might be sort of smokescreen. Does anyone have any? Can we take it forward as an option, or into regulation, essentially?
I'm going to respond because no one else was. So go
ahead. What I was going to say was when we did some initial consultation on this findings, we had quite a few from parents' groups who said that what's lacking here, and it all comes from this idea that you can't change this. This is the way things are now. We could contend against that. This is the way things are now, and this is going to become our children in greater and greater levels forever. And that what's needed is that parents are taken back a few generations and given the ability to say no more strongly, so that it actually becomes a public education issue. And I think there is an argument for media, for parents being more media aware, and for grandparents as well. The grandparents in this country spend hours and hours of their children's life with them alone, and are often the ones who are horrified by their level of consumption, their level of demand. I think there is a real issue here, but the question is how do you do that without lapsing into a complete nanny state, or certainly the media criticising you for being in the nanny state. But I think there is an argument for, because what happened without, the reason I'm saying this is what happened with our research is that a lot of parents initially, they were like, sorry, what's the problem? Is there a problem? And you say to people, have you had a finding Nemo? And then they would start to talk about the McDonald's Happy Meal, the film, the backpacking Woolworths, the ice cream, everything tied into a character that's very attractive to a small child. But unless you actually nudge a parent to be aware of that, they're not necessarily aware of it. And so I think there's an issue not only for children to be media literate, but actually for adults to be maintained to media literacy. So that maybe is something else to explore. And I think, because I think by the time a child's 12, the quick on the damage has been done.
So Ofcom, Andy Wilson, Ofcom's pretty new. It only started at the end of last year. And I'm not directly involved in media literacy myself, but I know that Ofcom is looking at not just children's media literacy, but parents, and trying to plan for both of those aspects. And I think there's a lot of money going to go into it, and it's not just being left to Media Smart, which obviously is the industry's own perspective.
Yes?
Hi, I'm my name is Alan Carroll. I'm from the Department of Education and Skills, and the role of government is. What's sort of interesting for me is the tension seems to be whether there really is an effect from discourse in relation to the two. Our
our task at the moment, though, what we're focused on most of all in the department, with things like green paint, is on preventative work to improve outputs and outcomes for children, and making services for children that can try and think about issues like this. And kind of what I've heard in each of the three pieces that's sort of drawn together is this kind of dichotomy between children being safe and children being happy. Because those are two of the outcomes, and they seem to be in almost direct conflict with each other. It's quite a difficult balance to strike, isn't it, and parent knows. For example, I've got a toddler, and I increasingly find myself switching between Nick Jr., which is what he wants, which has got lots of brilliant adverts, and some of them are credit card companies, which is puzzling, and CBB, which doesn't have any adverts, as far as I can see, rather other programs. And I know what I prefer, but I also know what he wants. So I think there's a, you rightly pointed to the government policy, and I think the direction that we're trying to take is a cautionary one, but it's also trying to square that circle between being safe and being happy. And we're finding it, I think, increasingly hard. I think this kind of discourse is very useful for that. But I think it's a much harder nut to crack than sitting back one thing or anything.
Do people feel that this is an argument that we've rehearsed already in relation to tobacco and alcohol? Because undoubtedly the safe and happy thing would apply to a split on both those issues. And I'd be interested to know if people feel that, you know, this is the beginning of the journey we travelled on tobacco and alcohol.
Well, if you look at the latest adverts around countering smoking behaviour, and I suspect that's more for people who've actually started smoking as a result of preventing it. They seem to have upped the scale and got a lot more severe and a lot more sort of upfront in their face. And certainly when I lived in Australia during the gap year, about 15 years ago, and there they were already getting very, very serious about drink driving. The adverts that I saw these had the nurse bringing in this bloody patient from a car accident, saying, "You're drinking, you're a bloody idiot." You know, this is exactly the sort of thing that I can see happening now with that fantasy in relation to that.
Can I just throw in, because the whole issue of the battle has traditionally taken place between parents and corporations, and the battle gets staged. It's an old one, as I try to point out. We've been struggling for 40 years around this issue, and when it comes down, and that's why I wanted to look at the tobacco and the, which is a kind of benchmark case, and obesity is being called the new tobacco in the United States, and you saw I think that the differences between the scientific debates, which will never be resolved, I think, that's one of the things we're aware of in a risk society, around video game violence, for example. You cannot prove, and I agree with Brian to some extent, but I don't believe you will ever get scientific proof of this kind of systemic cultural effect of intensive marketing. What we have evidence is of the heavy disproportion of promotion in one sector and the absence of alternatives in the marketplace being advocated. I think that's being rectified a little bit by the industry already. They need to be pressured to do more of that. And labeling, as in the tobacco case. So although we never had scientific proof that smoking cigarettes actually, there was a voluntary ban because of the publicity, and this is where the politics sometimes becomes more interesting than the actual science, I think. And I think that in many cases, that's why I think we study the moral panics around these issues, because they seem to have more effect. And forcing government to rethink their current positions is part of that. And I think increasingly governments are going to be asked to reformulate policies around these issues. It's the new tobacco, there's no question.
As to a bit from the direction that I might be concerned about the use of the term lifestyle in the presentation. I wonder whether there's a difference between lifestyle and life or living. Lifestyle to me implies that there is some choice products, you have various options. But what I've heard from the presentation here is that there really isn't a choice. What I'm wondering is whether we're backing at the moment some kind of materialist
acknowledgement that we are looking at the interests of global capital, and that in dealing with the interests of global capital, we're not talking about insurance, we're talking about susceptible, vulnerable people. What does that overstate?
Well, that's fun. Does anyone have a response on that? Well, global capital and
it's not on global capital, but on the word lifestyle. I use the word lifestyle risks, and that comes out of my looking at the obesity court cases in the United States. And a lot of that has to do with the notion of choice or discretionary risks, risks that are cumulative over a long period of time, which is not unlike a risk. A cigarettes have a lifestyle risk because the risks only accumulate over regular, and in the court cases, you can read it in my paper, I give an account of that. But this becomes the major issue. This is a very different kind of risk that the courts are having to adjudicate, because they are decisions to regularly consume a product over a long period of time, and the risks only accumulate in the long term, and that we're not always aware of those the risks because they're delinked from immediate consumption. So it's different than bovine spongiform, which governments can regulate and manage. But lifestyle risks, we don't have the regulatory tools for thinking about and communicating about those to children. So that's why I use that term. It's not to excuse global capitalism, but it's to draw a particular focus to a particular category of consumer action and consumer risks.
Yes, please.
Can I just add to that? Because I think also the interesting point about the lifestyle is they pose a different challenge to science. And I think it's implicit in what you have been saying, but you can't do the experiment that shows a child man and they get flat. The effects are cumulative over a very long time, and therefore you can't do the experiment that proves the case, and therefore, in the area of lifestyle risks, it's about you making arguments in quality terms that don't have that kind of scientific causal demonstration.
And because it's a multifactorial, I mean, Brian's point, it's very complex, multiple causalities, and our science is simply not up to identify.
And also, I think, because we can't gradually, deliberately expose children to adverts over a long time in little parts.
Do you actually have to be that anxious about taking precautionary measures? I mean, is it worth the risk to take them, despite lack of evidence?
Well, in risk science, the precautionary principle is accepted as the alternative to the Panglossian principle, and I think it's recognizing the world is not perfect and admitting that and helping kids understand that shifts the agenda radically, and we stop being accused of protectionism.
And just comment on that brief comment, actually, which is that. As far as I'm aware, and I haven't read the precaution principle in too much detail, but it would apply to certain categories of risk. And if I was wanting, for example, to ban advertising, which actually I don't, which perhaps haven't said that I don't, then it would to use advertiser's jargon would be very useful for me if I could position food as the new tobacco. Because that would then become an issue where the precautionary principle would certainly be applicable. If it wasn't a position as a new tobacco, then it wouldn't be a situation where the precautionary principle would be applicable, and then you have to deploy particular calculus of costs and benefits. I assume that the precautionary principle involves the calculus of costs and benefits, but you're erring on the side of caution, is that?
That's largely the case, yes. I mean, it also has to be said that the exercise, and this is one of the critiques of the precautionary principle, is that the exercise of precautionary action has consequences, some intended, some unintended, and that those consequences themselves pose what are called countervailing risks. So one of the exercises in deciding whether to adopt precautionary action or not is an assessment of countervailing risks. I think in relation to children's advertising, that may be a very productive way of mapping out the possible policy responses. Precautionary action in terms of countervailing risk and so on. To go back to just very briefly to pick up the point about globalization, because in a sense this was a point that I was trying to get to in relation to the control of symbolic resources. Now, I take fully the notion that the influences to which children, as indeed all people, are exposed is a relatively competitive discourse terrain in which various interests groups have inputs. But it does seem to me that in the case of advertising, it's quite clear that there is a very clear interest group in relation to, let's just call it commercial interest, for the sake of not calling it global capital, that there are benefits to those commercial interests from expanding their markets, in particular in children, not just because it's an additional market at the moment, but because the potential to shift the value systems of children as consumers has knock-on effects throughout their lives in the future. It's also clear, and this is the point that I was trying to make about the sphere of influence on children, that sphere of influence is dominated in particular developmental years by peer group elaboration of symbolic messages. So that very quickly, the ability of parental responsibility to play an influence in negating that, and indeed the ability of government or teacher campaigns to play a role in negating these hugely resourced, very well resourced commercial inputs as to symbolic resources that affect identity and affect the social construction of identity, the parental and government influences are very, very limited. And although I absolutely agree that, you know, encouraging literacy and campaigns to educate small children and indeed older children up to grandparents' age in literacy in relation to the media are extremely important, what I'm skeptical of is that the availability of the resources to match the resources that are being used to control the media through commercial interests.
Which is the whole issue of why do we give them a tax concession around doing this? I mean, the comparison I make is they get a tax concession for taking their clients out to lunch. And what I'm suggesting is the equivalent of saying buying your client dinner is fine, just don't buy them the alcohol on top. Make them pay out of their pocket for those things that are unnecessary for fair business practice. And around that, the thing is to begin to skew, because I think advertising can be a force for broad public education. It's part of that system. And what right now the skewing is that the risk information, is absented because of the promotional messages. Increasingly, you're finding advertisers, and I have some examples of how the fast food industry in America is responding to this challenge by including, Atkins-friendly labeling on their fast food and things like that. And I think before they undertake those kinds of promotional responses to, that we have to define what those kinds of information that we expect children to be exposed to in the marketplace so that they can make and become educated as consumers, socialized as competent consumers. That's the question I think we're addressing here in this panel.
So are we possibly talking about some kind of hypothecated tax concession to literacy? I mean, that obviously is an option. I just would like to put the point that, I mean, are we overloading our children with a combination of adverts plus education in how to deal with their consumer habits? I think perhaps I'll just leave that question for the next session. We've run out of time now, unless anyone has a burning issue they want to raise now. And to thank all our speakers. Is there anything that you want to round off at this stage? No, and we're going to close now for tea, and then the next session will be chaired by Frank, and then after that there'll be an open discussion with Anne. And thank you all for your interesting comments.